from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. A lot to share today. Pineapple's amazing healing properties, a Chinese plant compound that can wipe out cancer in 40 days. A new study, kids with fewer vaccines have fewer doctor and emergency room visits. A Kiwi study showing diet change can have a rapid impact upon inflammation. Then my guest in the second part of our program will be John Rapoport. John is a very talented investigative journalist, and we're going to talk about why he challenges any legitimacy in the HIV antibody test. I have said that no one in America should get the antibody test because it's absolutely fraudulent. We'll see what he has to say on it. Then I'm going to give you a newsmaker update, a call to action, about what Monsanto and its lobbyists were able to insert into a new farm bill that really it gives it carte blanche to do anything it wants without any oversight about genetic engineering. I'll give you the latest that you have not heard anywhere on what they just discovered hiding inside of a GM crop. Really scary stuff. Also, the latest on vaccines today, a lot of interesting material. Commentaries today, I will not offer my own commentary. I did that yesterday. Today, I will share a commentary from Norman Solomon from Nation of Change on Dr. Martin Luther King. I had a dream. And President Obama, I have a drone. Also, from Tony Cartolucci from Global Research, Barack Obama versus Martin Luther King, the greatest way to dishonor Martin Luther King Jr., and Martin Luther King's vehement condemnation of American militarism by Glenn Greenwald from The Guardian. Also, Dr. Cornel West on the way that the swearing-in ceremony and then later Obama using King's Bible. If time permits after that, I'll go into how many times have we heard that President Obama is the socialist president. He is anti-business. He is hurting business. Except, according to Bloomberg, the greatest amount of corporate profit since the Second World War, more than any other president in American history, has come under Barack Obama. Where do you see the figures? So as you see, we have a lot to share. Also, just so you know, we have a lot of new listeners. They email us what they like about the program, what they want to hear more of on the program, and we try to address this. For example, tomorrow, the importance of challenging the conventional narrative and myth of American history to understand how far the United States has drifted away from its democratic traditions. Professor Peter Kuznick, a professor of history specializing in American politics, nuclear history, and the Cold War, will be here. He also is the co-author of the Academy Award-winning film directed by Oliver Stone, The Untold History of the United States. Then the next day, can capitalism address and solve the environmental and social problems facing humanity and the planet? We're told yes. Let the market dictate. My guest, Jerry Mander, a veteran crusader in environmental, social, and anti-war causes, and one of the leaders of the anti-globalization, anti-free trade movement, and responsible for prevention of dams in the Great Grand Canyon and expanding our National Park Service in the 60s and 70s, says, no, we have to have a whole new system. And then we'll finish off the week with a phenomena of extinction, how humans have become estranged from nature. My guest will be noted British author Melanie Challenger, who journeyed around the world to investigate what has become extinct and is on the verge of extinction and understand the mindset that has brought about such a widespread extinction. So from extinction of species to what we need to do, what kind of system do we need to survive in the future, and taking an honest look at our history. Those are the issues for the remainder of the week. Let's begin. We should be paying attention to a particularly interesting plant from China. It has an unusual name, but it is known to kill cancer cells. In fact, it was able to cause tumor cells in mice with pancreatic cancer to completely disappear. It's known as the Thunder God Vine, or Li Gong Ting, LeiGongTeng. It's a very important part of Chinese medicine. It's been used for a long period of time for rheumatoid arthritis. According to new research out of the University of Minnesota's Cancer Center, this plant compound led to zero tumors after a 40-day period, even after discontinuing the treatment. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal Science Translational Medicine and funded by the National Institutes of Health. Even the scientists working on the project were absolutely taken aback by the anti-cancer properties of the compound. Inside the compound, there are chemicals called triptolide, T-R-I-P-T-O-L-I-D-E, which has been identified as a cancer fighter in previous research. And that's what gives it its anti-tumor properties, at least that's what they think. And here's what the leader of the study, the vice chairman of research at the Cancer Center, published, saying, quote, "This drug is just unbelievably potent in killing tumor cells," end quote. And as the report stated, just like with numerous other powerful substances like turmeric that we've talked about numerous times on this show, and ginger, mainstream science is slowly confirming what many traditional practitioners throughout the world have known their entire lives. And this is, of course, due to the fact that there is simply no money for major corporations in researching the natural healing powers of natural herbs or supplements. If they can't patent it, they're not going to research it. Turmeric and ginger, for example, have been found to be amazingly anti-cancer and are virtually free compared to expensive and dangerous cancer drugs. Nevertheless, it is good to see that a major study has been done to show how important this is. And let's be realistic. Profits that are threatened by the many real studies that are performed by scientists examining the rejuvenating power of inexpensive ingredients like turmeric, which have been found by peer review research available on PubMed to positively influence over 590 conditions. So right in the heart of mainstream and or orthodox medicine science is all the evidence. It's just not evidence that is proprietary. So good news. Now there's something for anyone who has cancer to look forward to using. Something that we can all use, and many cultures use it on a regular daily basis, are the pineapples. Now, there are different types of pineapples, but this is true for almost all pineapples. And what is it about the pineapple that makes a difference? Well, it's chemistry. It's not just that it's one of the richest sources of bromelain. And bromelain, brome, B-R-O-M, elaine, E-L-A-I-N, it's a protein-digesting enzyme extract from the pineapple at the core of the pineapple. There is some in the rest of the pineapple as well. And it has been compared head-to-head with the very expensive and very toxic chemotherapy agent 5-fluorouracil as an anti-tumor agent in preclinical research. And the pineapple enzyme kills cancer cells, but it is safe. So here are some things that we know that the pineapple, especially the core, and by the way, I've now seen in some supermarkets where you can just buy the core. It's very cheap because evidently they think nobody will give any value to it. And remember, you have to look at the real value of things, not the artificial value. So people are eating the flesh, good, but they're not eating the core. But now people are asking for the core, so they know they're actually saving the core. What do we know? It's great for asthma, breast cancer. It is good for women who are trying to breastfeed but have poor milk production. Colitis in babies. Colon cancer. It's terrific for postoperative constipation. Edema, any swelling around the body. It stimulates immune system. It is the best of the best for turning off inflammation. It is good if you have about 1 cup of the core of the pineapple with vitamin C and wild oregano oil and what is without question the best honey, the Manuka, M-A-N-U-K-A. And it should say on the front of the label, bioactive, and then it gives you a number. I suggest 20 plus. Now, this comes from New Zealand. It's the only place I'm aware of it, and from the special trees. And Manuka honey is a monofloral honey. It's used traditionally by the native Morai people of New Zealand, and it comes from the pristine native forest where it's collected by hand, and it should be... and it lasts a long, long time. I mean, if you had a bottle of honey and you didn't use it for 5 years, it wouldn't matter. It's still good. But you make that into a smoothie and you drink that if you have any signs of a cold or flu. It will help you if you've had liver problems, if you've had a heart attack or osteoporosis, if you've had swelling in your tendons. So... those are the things that can make a difference. Now, there's a study by the Journal of the American Medical Association that shows, and I'll quote this, it is entitled A Population-Based Cohort Study of Undervaccinated in Vaccination in 8 Managed Care Organizations Across the United States. And what it says is this. In the article, to examine, quote, patterns and trends of under-vaccination in children ages 2 to 24 months and to compare healthcare utilization rates between under-vaccinated and age-appropriately vaccinated children, end quote. The kids with the fewest vaccinations had the fewest doctor problems and the fewest emergency room visits. Now, you'd think that that would get someone's attention. But it didn't. And yet there it is. They're telling you those that got the fewest vaccines had the fewest problems. And finally, on the health nutrition segment today, Kiwi study shows diet change can have rapid impact on inflammation. A proof of principle study has shown that a change in diet can be remarkably important at right now, I mean just in 6 weeks, reducing out inflammation. Moreover, the findings by Lynette Ferguson, professor of nutrition at Acland University, showed that short-term research with relatively small numbers of participants can be capable of yielding robust results. Quote, inflammation can be the catalyst for chronic human disease, including Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, and some cancers, as well as various autoimmune diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, and type 2 diabetes. It has been established in many studies that this inflammation can be reduced through a diet which is high in long-chained omega-3 fatty acids, fruit and vegetables, nuts and whole grains, and is low in refined grains, saturated fats, and sugars. Many of these dietary components characterize the Mediterranean diet, which has been shown to protect against chronic disease. End quote. And they did this study and found that in a very short period of time, in 6 weeks, they were able to turn off a lot of inflammation. This was with 30 individuals. Now, I have yet to publish, but I'm putting it up on high on priority to publish a study that I did a year ago. It was a year ago as we speak, where I took about 80 individuals who had long-term arthritis, who had been under treatment and were under treatment when they came in the study from physicians, and who had the average was 7 years that they had arthritis. Some had it for as long as 20 years. And some were absolutely crippled. One woman came in who had a claw-like hand, meaning the hand and fingers were in a claw-like position, couldn't open them. They were frozen. Another man could not turn his head to the left or the right. His neck and vertebrae were locked in a frozen position. And others couldn't even walk up the steps. In 4 weeks, 28 days, those who were on the protocol were able to improve or reverse all their arthritic conditions. Followed up 3 months, 6 months, and even now, they have only continued to improve. So there's another example of even a shorter study, but double the number of people, and we had them measuring all other blood pressure and percentage of body fat and energy levels and sleep and frequency of urination during the night, all these other 30 conditions, and all made statistical improvements. So they are correct. And now I got to get that study published. A few environmental issues. This is from a new farm bill that the average American wouldn't care anything about. But according to Caroline Wright of Natural News, we should. Because take note of this, please, and write your House member. It's H.R. 5973. I repeat, H.R., that means House Representatives, 5973. It's the Agricultural, Rural Development, Food and Drug Administration and Related Agencies Appropriation Act 2013. Now, here's what will happen if it passes. Quote, the Farm Bill is a package of federal legislation enacted every 5 to 7 years to set the general direction of America's farm and food policy. Congress enacted the first Farm Bill in the wake of the Great Depression with the dual goals of supporting America's farmers and ranchers. In H.R. 5973, otherwise known as the Monsanto Protection Act, carries a small rider in Section 733, write that down, Section 733, that grants biotech companies free rein with no oversight. The legal team at the Center for Food Safety translates Section 333 as a, quote, dangerous assault on fundamental federal and judicial safeguards and would create a precedent-setting limitation on judicial review. That's according to Food Democracy Now. And if this is allowed to pass, the Monsanto Protection Act fundamentally, quote, undermines the concept of judicial review and would strip judges of their constitutional mandate to protect consumer rights and the environment while opening up the floodgates for the planting of new untested genetically engineered crops, endangering farms, consumers, and the environment. So call or email your House member today and say, you are adamantly opposed to H.R. 5973, Section 733. Okay? And we'll post this on our website as a call to action. Now, following up on that, here's something no one in this audience has known. This is the latest, and this comes from Sean Poulter, Consumer Affairs Editor. Quote, the European Union Watchdog Agency reveals approval for GM foods fails to identify a poisonous gene. Now, this is what's important. 54 of 86 GM plants approved contain the dangerous gene. The gene found in food for farm animals includes meat, milk, and eggs. Now, what it is, it's a virus gene. In just lay language, it's a virus gene that could be poisonous to humans, and it's been missed when GM food crops have been assessed for safety. And GM crops such as corn and soya, which are being grown around the world for both human and animal consumption, include the gene. Now, a new study from the European Food Safety Authority, which is officially the food watchdog of the European Union, has revealed that the international approval process for GM crops failed to identify the gene. As a result, watchdogs have not investigated its impact on human health and the plants themselves when assessing whether they are safe. The findings are particularly powerful because the work was carried out by independent experts rather than any genetically modified critics. It was led by Nancy Podivin, who was employed by the European Food Safety Authority, and Patrick Desjardins, of the Plant Biology Unit at the University of Liège in Belgium. And they discovered that 54 of 86 GM plants approved for commercial growing and food in the United States, including corn and soy, contained the viral gene, which is known as gene 6. Now, in this country, these crops are typically fed to farm animals producing meat, milk, and eggs. And significantly, the European Safety Agency researchers concluded that the presence of segments of gene 6 might result in unintended, quote, phenotypic changes, end quote. Now, such changes include the creation of proteins that are toxic to humans, and they could also trigger changes in the plants themselves, making them more vulnerable to pests. And many people, myself included, say the revelations make it clear that GM approval process, which has been in place for 20 years, is just totally corrupt. We argue that the only correct response is to recall all the crops and food products involved. Director of the campaigning group, GM Freeze, Pete Riley, said the discovery of the gene, quote, totally undermines claims that GM technology is safe, precise, and predictable. He said, quote, this is a clear warning that genetically modified food is not sufficiently understood to be considered safe, and that we must suspend all genetically modified plantings. And typically, GM crops are modified in the laboratory to give them resistance to being sprayed with powerful weed killers like Monsanto's Roundup. This means that, in theory, fields can be doused with the chemical, so wiping out the weeds and allowing the food plants to thrive. But it doesn't work that way. If you saw the movie Seeds of Death, you saw super weeds now taking the place of regular weeds. It's been assumed that virus genes are not present in the plant once it's grown in the field and reaches the consumers. However, now we know that's not the case. So, quote, this is from the Independent Science News, said the presence of the viral gene appears to have been missed by biotech companies, university, and government regulatories. Quote, this situation represents a complete and catastrophic system failure. There are clear indications that this viral gene might not be safe for human consumption. It also may disturb the normal functioning of crops, including their natural pest resistance. A reasonable concern is that the protein produced by gene 6 might be a human toxin. This is a question that can only be answered by future experiments. End quote. And mind you, that's Independent Science News. So one more reason why we don't want Monsanto being able to have this legislation that they, through their lobbyists and paying the good fees that the lobbyists get, were able to influence the legislative process. Finally, two things. The heat brings earliest spring blooms on record from Boston University. Quote, unusually warm spring weather has resulted in the earliest blooms on record in two U.S. locations, new study found. And researchers say there's serious concern. In fact, records kept since 1852 in Massachusetts, initially by Henry David Thoreau near Walton Pond, and since 1935 in Wisconsin, including observations by environmental pioneer Aldo Leopold, show that common wildflowers now blossom 20 days earlier and 24 days earlier, respectively, than in the past. Now, why is this important? Why would you care? Because as a farmer, as someone who has studied organic farming for decades and has an organic farm, plants need a long winter to undergo the physiological changes required to bloom in the spring. So if you have a short winter and they cannot fully mature, then what you get is you'll have a plant blooming and frequently a stunted growth or no growth at all. And that's why some farmers are saying, wow, this year I didn't get any plums on my tree. And normally I get 400 or 500 per tree. Well, that's what happens when the temperature gets too high. Now also, I'm seeing loquats blooming 2.5 months before they should. They should not bloom until March. They've been blooming since December. I'm seeing citrus blooming much earlier. They're blooming in June instead of in the fall. So this is causing a cycle, and this cycle is going to cause havoc with a lot of the crops in the United States. And finally, on the environmental front, the Mississippi River may soon be unnavigable, despite the Army engineers' best efforts. This is from the Army Corps of Engineers, is nearly out of options for keeping a section of the river open and flowing. This is Clay Dillon. And what it is between Cairo, Illinois, and St. Louis, it's simply the water is too shallow. The Corps of Engineers has been digging holes to gain another 2 feet. Otherwise, you have thousands and thousands of barges that bring tens of billions of dollars up the Mississippi and from mid-America and down. And it's happening now. So that's another impact from the environment. Now to the information on vaccines. A federal court admits hepatitis B vaccine caused a fatal autoimmune disorder. From Natural News, quote, in our society today, newborns are injected with loads of chemicals nearly as soon as they enter the world. In the name of prevention, we give them vaccines that we aren't even sure are safe. As a matter of fact, in many cases, we know they are unsafe. This is the case of the hepatitis B vaccine approved for infants at birth, but admittedly responsible for causing serious illness and even death. The United States Court of Federal Claims sided with the estate of Tambra Harris, who died as a result of an autoimmune disease called systemic lupus erythematosus. The court awarded $475,000 following her death after finding the hepatitis vaccine caused her injury. And so that's just one more reason. And by the way, the hepatitis B vaccine, if the parents, especially the mother, is hepatitis B negative, absolutely positively is worthless and is dangerous. This is from the Daily Mail publisher's MMR letter from the Age of Autism, quote, dear sir, a payment of $600,000 in the United States of America is compensation for the MMR vaccine, that means measles, mumps, rubella, damage leading to autism in a child, follows a $1 million payout a few days earlier for the same tragic scenario. It is my understanding that up to 100 families in America have now been compensated in recognition of the neurological harm that the MMR vaccine can do, although as part of the compensation, each family had to sign a confidentiality agreement, and there are many more USA cases awaiting a decision. Last year, a small boy in Rimini was similarly compensated for the autism he developed following an MMR vaccine. The Italian government did not challenge the court decision. Hundreds more cases are in the pipeline in Italy. In the UK, over 1,500 families entered litigation claiming MMR had led to autism in their child. Legal aid was suspiciously withdrawn and the parents were abandoned with their seriously ill children who had and still have known painful, treatable, comorbid underlying medical conditions. What does this tell us about the mindset and morals of the guardians of the public health in the UK? It tells us that the ancient Carthaginian policy of child sacrifice is alive and well and has full approval in the shadier quarters of Whitehall. The promotion and protection of a deeply flawed vaccine program has overruled common sense and common decency. To damage perfectly healthy children in a crude experiment is undoubtedly a criminal offense and must be treated as such. It is high time that our politicians realize that they, along with the citizens of the United Kingdom, have been misled about the safety of the MMR vaccine. End quote, Bill Walsh. And finally, Vermont whooping cough outbreak involves 90% vaccinated kids. Quote, Vermont is experiencing the most severe outbreak of pertussis or whooping cough in documented history. While state numbers show the vaccine inefficiency in the Green Mountain State, top health officials say there's no better solution. Well, and here's the catch in this, 90% of the kids who had their full vaccinations developed whooping cough. So then how do you say that how do you say it's effective when 90% of the kids who were fully vaccinated get the disease? Then it's not. And finally, this is a scientific article from the Department of Psychiatry, Ohio State University Medical Center, Ohio. It's an abstract. Inflammation response to trivalent influenza virus vaccine among pregnant women. I decided to pull this because I was looking at when we say that vaccines are safe, what does the average person do to verify it? Well, this study shows that, quote, conclusions, the actual scientific peer review study, trivalent influenza virus vaccine elicits a measurable inflammatory response among pregnant women. So every time a pregnant woman gets a flu shot, you're creating an inflammation in your body. And this verifies that. And that is not good, and that is not safe, especially when you're talking about pregnant women. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. Next up, my guest, John Rappaport. Following that will be a series of short but important commentaries involving Martin Luther King's holiday, which just passed, and President Obama's inauguration, to put it into a slightly different perspective. And also, I'm going to give you a number, because all over the United States, Canada, and I'm not sure about Mexico, but a lot of people cannot be at an apartment or home listening over the radio as historically was necessary. I can't tell you how many people say, I don't leave my home until I hear your show. You know, but there is a number that you can call. And when you call this number, you can listen over your telephone anywhere. I have cab drivers, truck drivers. I was in an airport the other day, and a guy came over and said, "Hey, Gary," he says, "I'm on my way home to see my family. Just want to let you know that I'm listening to you every day." I said, "What do you do?" He said, "I'm a truck driver." I said, "Where do you drive?" He said, "Oh, I drive New York to L.A. I said, "Well, how do you listen? You can't listen over the Internet." He said, "No, I listen over the telephone. I just put it on, have it on speaker, and listen." Here's the phone number for all of you who don't have Internet or are not available to a land-based station, 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. Back in a moment with my guest, John Rappaport. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you to our program. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go to our guest, but I was just told that I'm on the road filming a very important documentary that I hope to premiere in about 3 months. But joining in studio is our program director, Jason. Hi, Jason.
Hi, good afternoon, Gary. I just wanted to come on and really thank our listeners and our fans for this week alone. 35,800 new unique listeners came on board just to join us. And we had 226,000 people come to our archives, read our articles, and see our videos this past week. At this rate, Gary, we should have about 2 million new, young, educated people in the age from 25 to 55, women and men, that will join us in the next year and over the 12-month period. So it's absolutely amazing. We want to thank everyone who's helping us grow at great rates.
Well, having 2 million new, young listeners who are educated and involved in social issues and willing to share information with one to another and take a position on helping to change some negatives to positives, it's certainly appreciated. And by the way, anyone who's in the media, you ask Bill O'Reilly, you ask Rush Limbaugh, what would
Sean Hannity, none of them.
No one gets these kind of numbers, new listeners. They're getting old people and generally non-active. These are young and vital activists. So I want to thank the 37,000 new people who have come on board in the last week. Those are serious numbers. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
And by the way, last night's progressive commentary was a scorcher. It caught me by surprise. I only had one guest, and this woman, who had been one of the top people inside the national intelligence community, the Defense Department, and at the White House, as special advisor to the chief advisor to the president, she made some statements just bowled everyone over, including her claim that she could fully support that Osama bin Laden, prior to 9/11, had been a CIA asset. And that's one of the reasons why the Saudis were given a way out of the country immediately, and also why she believes that that was not Osama bin Laden whose body was killed. The raid, yes, and she talks about why. You got to listen to it. Go to the archives and download Progressive Commentary Hour. It's a scorcher. Now, another gentleman who is coming up with some really unusual insights on to change the way we look at news stories is John Rappaport. John has worked as an investigative journalist for over 30 years. He writes about politics and corporatocracy, alternative health and the medical cartels and the media and the culture. He's published in LA Weekly, Spin, Stern, Village Voice, Nexus, CBS Health Watch, etc. And in fact, he was his work on military reporting on the military in El Salvador earned him a submission for the Pulitzer Prize. He's also hosted many shows, and he's for the last 10 years he's operated largely away from the mainstream media. His website is nomorefakenews.com. Nice to have you with us, John.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be here.
John, I read an article of yours this morning. The article was entitled "The Massive Fraud Behind HIV Tests." I'll quote the first paragraph and then we'll discuss, all right?
Sure.
On July 12, 2006, ABC News ran a story about testing all adults in America for HIV. Quote, this from ABC, along with Washington's new screening program, the National Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, is expected to release similar guidelines this summer that would expand HIV screening to all adults in the United States. If this happens, it means that just about anybody over the age of 13 could be asked by their doctor to take an HIV test. End quote. Although this would not be a compulsory program, it would be another step in that direction. And of course, in a doctor's office or in a hospital, many patients simply go along with doctor's recommendations. If a doctor says that they want to get you tested, there's little likelihood that you will not give your consent. The CDC is also claiming that today's HIV and HIV tests are much more accurate than the tests done in the early years of AIDS. However, in the early years, the U.S. health authorities asserted that standard HIV tests were 99.78% accurate, which is to say the very, very thin perspective there. But, and then you go into talking about all the people who were tested for HIV who were found to have false positives, and you give specific updates. This one is from a press release out of San Francisco. A promising new oral HIV test that uses fluid swabbed from the mouth to quickly and easily detect the virus that causes AIDS incorrectly diagnosed a quarter of all the people tested positive in San Francisco City. And people were tested for HIV, then told they were positive when in fact they were not positive. 47 who tested positive after using the advanced HIV test in city clinics were not infected at all, the San Francisco Department of Public Health said. So apparently not all HIV tests are as accurate. Now, that is just a small part of this article. What this told me was that this should have been done by the New York Times, the Washington Post, certainly the San Francisco Chronicle and Los Angeles Times, that the HIV antibody test is not accurate. At the same time that the CDC and the AIDS groups that are supported and paid for by Burroughs Wellcome and the other drug manufacturers are trying to get everyone tested. So on the one hand, there's a big push to get people tested. On the other hand, and make it mandatory, on the other hand, the test is a complete fraud. There's absolutely no science to validate that there's a gold standard, meaning if you take an HIV antibody test, the only positive result will be if you have the HIV in your body. But that's not the case. Start there and tell us why you believe that the HIV antibody test is not accurate and give us some examples.
Okay. Well, this is a double-decker fraud. We start off with the idea that you are testing for antibodies to the HIV virus. Now, the test can do what's called cross-react. In other words, it shows positive, but there are no antibodies to HIV in your body. It's actually reacting on a whole variety of other possibilities, such as you received a hepatitis B vaccine, such as you happen to be drinking alcohol recently. Christine Johnson, a very good independent reporter years ago, found 60 factors, irrelevant factors, that could cause the HIV antibody test to register positive when, in fact, it had nothing to do with the presence of HIV in the body. So we start with that. And that has not been mitigated or changed, as you've just indicated, by so-called advances in the accuracy of the antibody test at all. So starting from there, this would be a very good reason why people would not want to get tested at all. But the larger fraud has to do with the notion of looking for antibodies in the first place. Now, an antibody, to put it in layman's terms, is simply a messenger of the immune system that identifies, quote, invaders that are coming into the body and marks them for neutralization or destruction by the rest of the immune system. Prior to the development of the HIV test or the purported discovery that AIDS is caused by HIV, it was well understood in the medical community that when you tested and showed that you had an antibody in your body or antibodies in your body that were specific to a certain germ, it was in fact a good sign, a positive sign. It meant that your immune system had contacted that germ and had neutralized it, because that's what the immune system does. That was the overwhelming consensus of medical opinion. To put it more precisely, an antibody test only indicates, if it's accurate, that the immune system has made some sort of contact with a particular germ. It doesn't mean you had a disease or you now have a disease or you're going to get a disease. It says absolutely nothing about that. But then, all of a sudden, with the onset of fraudulent research by Robert Gallo and others who were attempting to find the so-called cause of AIDS, everything was thrown upside down on its head, because it was wrongly assumed that if a person had HIV in his body, that he was marked for death, that it was invariably lethal. Therefore, if an antibody test showed that your body had contacted that virus, HIV, you were going to die. That was a completely absurd and insane assumption, as I've illustrated and proved many times by talking to people, interviewing people who have been diagnosed as HIV positive and have survived wonderfully over very, very long periods of time, without taking any drugs, without listening to the advice of their doctor. So now we have a situation where it's not just about HIV anymore. It's about, for example, the flu. Whenever a person gets an antibody test for the flu, and the doctor says, well, this is positive, it means absolutely nothing, because all the presence of antibodies indicates is that most probably your body has contacted a flu virus and successfully defended the body against it. But now it's all turned upside down, and all medical tests for antibodies that have to do with any disease or any germ are immediately read out by the doctor as a negative sign, a bad sign, that you need medication, toxic medication, or you should have gotten vaccinated, or any variety of things, all of which are false. And so the entire medical system has been corrupted even further than it was by this lunatic misinterpretation of what antibodies are all about and what an antibody test reveals. So that, in a nutshell, is what I discovered in my research about AIDS that led to my original book, AIDS, Inc., in 1988, and further research on antibody tests since that time.
Fair enough. So just to summarize what you have said, anyone who takes an HIV antibody test, you're not testing for the virus because they can't find the virus. Instead, you're testing for what they're historically are saying protects you. Everyone who's asked to get a flu shot or any shot or the MMR vaccine is because it's going to create antibodies. And it's the antibody that then becomes protective. That's the reasoning. But in the subject of AIDS, since they can't find the virus that supposedly is killing people, they say, well, look for the antibodies. The trouble is, if you have herpes, hepatitis, if you've been drinking alcohol, if you're pregnant, if you've had tuberculosis, or if you've ever had malaria, if you are on, if you're hemophiliac, taking the hemophiliac drugs, if you have certain heart medications, all of these can test you, including pregnancy, positive for the HIV virus when you're actually negative. So therefore, the only groups of people that represent, well, about 98% of all the people who've been tested positive are the same group that has always been tested positive. Fast-track gays, intravenous drug users, more often than not heterosexuals, and the hemophiliacs. It has not been shown in the general population, nor in otherwise healthy people, who the fact that they're healthy doesn't mean that they wouldn't be HIV positive. And also where we have, so the whole test is a false. There are over 77 different things you could have that would give you a false positive reasoning. Now, if you look at the epidemic of sexually transmitted diseases, especially in young people, then you should see a concomitant increase in HIV diagnosis. You do not, because where they're getting syphilis and gonorrhea and human papillomavirus and all this other sexually transmitted disease, they're not getting HIV infection. Therefore, that should put the lie to the myth that, oh, it's primarily sexually transmitted. So almost everything we've been told about the HIV equals AIDS theory is wrong. Now, HIV does exist in 30 different manifestations, but these have always existed and should be treated as they historically have been, as individual conditions, not with these toxic drugs. That said, did I summarize you accurately or inaccurately?
No, you summarized it very accurately, and it's even worse than that, because not only can't they actually find the HIV virus in a person's body, but there are many other germs about which that is basically true. If they actually look for it and try to isolate it and discover it, they can't find it, or it's not there. Or most of the time, they don't even bother to try to isolate it or find it. So when people go in and they get tested for any sort of germ or disease, they naively believe that somehow the laboratory is, you know, somebody in the lab has a tweezer, you know, and they're, oh, there's the virus. It doesn't work that way at all. They rarely look for the actual germ. And so when you're being tested, 99.9% of the time, they are testing indirectly for what they consider to be a reliable marker that, yes, you do have that germ in your body. And these so-called reliable markers are completely unreliable. So it applies even across a much broader spectrum than HIV.
Good. John, are you available tomorrow for a newsmaker update?
Let's see. Tomorrow is Wednesday, right?
Yeah, I'd like to have you back on a different topic.
Okay. I have an appointment between 10 and 11 on the West Coast, my time, but other than that, I'm completely free.
Then we will continue with a different topic tomorrow with you, because you have so much information, and it's so dense. There's so much input into it. I want to leave it with this today, that you're challenging the legitimacy of the entire basis of HIV detection, and I fully support you with this. But now tomorrow I want to go to a different topic with you in your investigations. John Rappaport, my guest. The website is nomorefakenews.com, a very important website. We'll have him back tomorrow. Now, listen to Cornel West share some views on the inauguration of President Obama and comparing it with Martin Luther King.
But when I got the news that my dear brother Barack Obama, President Obama, was going to put his precious hand on Martin Luther King Jr.'s Bible, I got upset. And I got upset because you don't play with Martin Luther King Jr. and you don't play with his people. And by his people, what I mean is people of good conscience, fundamentally committed to peace and truth and justice, and especially the black tradition that produced him. All the blood, sweat, and tears that went into producing a Martin Luther King Jr. generated a brother of such high decency and dignity that you don't use his prophetic fire as just a moment in a presidential pageantry without understanding the challenge that he presents to all of those in power, no matter what color they are. No matter what color they are. So the righteous indignation of a Martin Luther King Jr. becomes a moment in political calculation. And that makes my blood boil. Why? Because Martin Luther King Jr., he died owing to three crimes against humanity he was wrestling with. Jim Crow, traumatizing, terrorizing, stigmatizing black people, lynching and so forth. Not just segregation, the way the press likes to talk about it. Second, carpet bombing in Vietnam, killing innocent people, especially innocent children. Those are war crimes Martin Luther King Jr. was willing to die for. And thirdly, was poverty of all colors. He said it's a crime against humanity for the richest nation in the history of the world to have so many of its precious children of all colors and living in poverty, and especially on the chocolate side of the nations, and on Indian reservations, and brown barrios, and yellow slices, and black ghettos then. We call them hoods now, but ghettos then. So I said to myself, okay, there's nothing wrong with putting your hand on the Bible, even though the Bible's talking about justice, and Jesus is talking about the least of these. But when you put it Martin's Bible, I said, this is personal for me, because this is a tradition that I come out of. This is a tradition that's connected to my grandmother's prayers and my grandfather's sermons and my mother's tears and my father's smile. And it's over against all of those in power who refuse to follow decent policies. So I say to myself, Brother Martin Luther King Jr., what would you say about the new Jim Crow? What would you say about the prison industrial complex? What would you say about the invisibility of so many of our prisoners, so many of our incarcerated, especially when 62% of them are there for soft drugs, but not one executive of a Wall Street bank gone to jail? Not one. Martin doesn't like that. Not one wiretapper. Not one torturer under the Bush administration. At all. Then what'd you say about the drones being dropped on our precious brothers and sisters in Pakistan and Somalia and Yemen? Those are war crimes, just like war crimes in Vietnam. Martin Luther King Jr., what would you say? My voice hollers out, then don't tame it. With your hand on his Bible, allow his prophetic voice to be heard. Martin, what would you say about the poverty in America now, beginning with the children and then the elderly, then our working folk and all colors, not just here, around the world? Don't
hide and conceal his challenge, don't tame his prophetic fire. So as much as I'm glad that Barack Obama won, I think that Brother Mitt Romney would have been a catastrophe, and I understand my Brother Newt told the truth of him about vampire capitalism, but that's true for the system as a whole, not just Mitt Romney in that regard. But when Barack Obama attempts to use that rich tradition, Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells Barnett, use the tradition of A. Philip Randolph, use the tradition of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, use the tradition of Tom Hayden and so many others struggling to produce that voice that pushed Martin in the direction that he did, I get upset. People say, oh, Brother West, there's Smiley and West hating Obama. No, no, we just loving the tradition that produced Martin Luther King Jr., and we're not going to allow it to be in any way sanitized, deodorized, and sterilized. We want the subversive power to be heard. That's what made me think when he said he's going to put his hand on that Bible.
And that was Cornel West giving his perspective. I'm still of the mindset that the Nobel Committee should rescind the Nobel Peace Prize to the most warlike president that we've had in decades. And you realize, don't you, that if Martin Luther King were alive today, based upon the power of his oratory, the power of his persuading so many people to look at their conscious choices, that he would be number one on the terrorist watch list by the FBI and Homeland Security. And it's highly probable that the danger he would represent to corporate profits and to the political system in the United States, that he could be, and this is the irony, he could be chosen by the National Defense Authorization Act signed by President Obama that gives him the exclusive right to decide who to kill. One Nobel Peace Prize winner ends up deciding that there's one other Nobel Peace Prize winner that shouldn't have the right to state the obvious. What a conundrum that puts us in. I'm Gary Nall. For the people listening to the regular part of our program, I want to thank you. We look forward to sharing more tomorrow. For everyone else listening over the internet or over our phone number, we'll continue for a while. Now, this is from Tony Carlucci from Global Research, Barack Obama versus Martin Luther King. What's the greatest way to dishonor Martin Luther King Jr.? Compare him with U.S. President Barack Obama, a servant of an engine for the greatest disparity, inequality, and injustice on earth. Driven by the very corporate financier interests King stood up against, was opposed by throughout his entire life, and most likely was killed by. For Martin Luther King Jr., whose famous speeches still echo through the halls of time, who spoke a message of peace and of the importance of character over the mere color of one's skin, he is ironically compared to Barack Obama simply because of the color of their skin, despite the fact that those two men possess the opposite in character and represent infinitely opposing causes. Indeed, despite the left-leaning facade President Obama displays publicly, his entire cabinet, past and present, is a collection of corporate financiers, special interests, warmongers, criminals, and elitists who merely couch a corporate fascist self-serving agenda behind well-meaning liberal-esque causes. A look at these characters more closely reveals just that. And then he goes into who has Obama selected and what's their connections. Timothy Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, he's a member of the Group of 30, as well as the Council on Foreign Relations. And Eric Holder, a top lawyer, Covington and Burlington, lobbied for Merck and representing Cheetah Bananas International in lawsuits brought by relatives of people killed by Colombian terrorists. Eric Shinseki, Council on Foreign Relations, and Ron Emanuel, Freddie Mac, William Daley, former Chief of Staff, J.P. Morgan, Executive Member, Jacob Lowe, Council on Foreign Relations, Brookings Institute, Susan Rice, Brookings Institute's Council on Foreign Relations, and Peter Volcker, a Council on Foreign Relations, and on, all major corporate insiders. And finally, King, I Have a Dream, Obama, I Have a Drone, from Norman Solomon. This is short. A simple twist of fate has set President Obama's second inaugural address the same day as Martin Luther King Jr.'s national holiday. Obama made no mention of King during the inauguration 4 years ago, but since then, in word and deed, the president has done much to distinguish himself from the man who said, "I have a dream." After his speech at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in August 1963, King went on to take great risk as a passionate advocate for peace. After his inaugural speech in January 2009, Obama has pursued policies that epitomize King's grim warning in 1967, when King said, quote, "When scientific power outruns moral power, we end up with guided missiles and misguided men." But Obama has not ignored King's anti-war legacy. On the contrary, the president has gone out of his way to distort and belittle it. In his 11th month as president, while escalating the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan, a process that tripled the American troop levels there, Obama traveled to Oslo to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. In his speech, he cast aspersions on the peace advocacy of another Nobel Peace Prize winner, Martin Luther King Jr. The president struck a respectful tone as he whetted the rhetorical knife before twisting, "I know there is nothing weak, nothing passive, nothing naive in the creed and lives of Gandhi and King," he said, but just before swiftly implying that those two advocates of nonviolent direct action were, in fact, passive and weak. Quote, "I face the world as it is and cannot stand idly in the face of threats to the American people," Obama added. Moments later, he was straining to justify America's warfare, past, present, and future. Quote, "To say that force may sometimes be necessary is not a call to cynicism. It is a recognition of history, the imperfections of man, and the limits of reason. I raise this point to begin with this point because in many countries there's a deep ambivalence about military action today, no matter what the cause. And at times this is joined by a reflexive suspicion of America, the world's sole military power." And then came Obama's pitch, quote, "Whatever mistakes we have made, the plain fact is the United States of America has helped underwrite global security for more than six decades when the blood of our citizens and the strength of our arms were at risk," end quote. Crowing about the moral virtues of making war while accepting a peace prize might seem a bit odd, but Obama's rhetoric was in sync with a key dictum from Orwell: who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's say hello to Luann. Hi, Luann. Your turn. Oh, she's not on? Then let's say hello to Eutrice Lee to see what she has coming at us today. In her
hello, mind. Gary.
Hi, Eutrice.
We're talking about malice in Mali and madness in D.C.
Good. I look forward to that because you and I both know that the only reason that France is in Mali is because the United States didn't want to look as if it were invading yet another country, so as it did with NATO in Libya, where France was the leading provocateur nation. It's the resources. Mali's rich in gold. It's rich in, and there's two sections of Mali. It's rich in gold and oil and diamonds and silver.
And uranium.
And uranium. And,
yes.
And so it's just another way of having neocolonial power, but supplying weapons to known terrorists to destabilize the country. Destabilized through a coup in a democratically elected government. So, but behind all of this is the United States and our distorted, perverted, totally corrupt military-industrial complex just looking for another way in a geopolitical environment to control other people's resources. Look forward to your show.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Eutrice Lee, coming at you now on the number one internet radio station in the world, Progressive Radio Network.
Put you down.